Shamily, welcome to KABU.
Thank you so much for having me, Bill.
Soraya Shamily is a writer, blogger, critical feminist. Her work can be found on the Huffington Post and the website Women Under Siege, amongst many other places. If you want to find her, though, her last name begins with a C, Shamily, C-H-E-M-A-L-Y. Soraya, you've written on football. Yesterday was Super Bowl Sunday, when the best of the best go out there and try to kill one another. For the hundreds of millions, maybe actually billions this year, of people around the planet watching, the game gets competed with and sometimes even overshadowed by the corporate advertising and the military presence, as well as, of course, the dancing women. Soraya, you wrote that the most important question about football for parents and all of us is not so much the injuries, although they are severe and long-lasting, but what lessons you wrote, on quotes, what lessons kids are learning about how to define themselves and how to relate to one another. You answered that question. They were pretty terrible lessons. Did yesterday's game have anything that caused you to alter that opinion?
Not really. I mean, yesterday's game, of course, is a high point of the year for many people. It's a lot of fun. It's part of our national imagination. And as you and I've discussed, there are lots of very positive aspects, obviously, to having communities and being fans and supporting your team. But the structure of the game itself, I think, tells a pretty difficult and destructive story. So no, I would have to say probably not.
Give us a sense of your critique.
Well, I think that it's interesting that this is our national sport, right? It's definitely a man's world sport. So in football, although girls do play football, there just gets to be a point where it's not really pragmatic or feasible or safe. And so they can't often play with boys. There are sports in which that's not the case. There are also sports in which boys and girls can excel as peers in parallel to one another. Again, football is not that sport. And so, you know, I think most people can't name women's professional football leagues. And when the women's football league that became the fastest growing league in the nation started to grow, it was largely because it was the lingerie football league, right? And they were dressed in lingerie. So I think it's undoubtedly the case that it's a man's game. Secondly, it's a man's game in which girls and women continue to be marginal. They are literally on the sidelines in a supportive role. And I think that's really actually quite comforting for people in some ways, because it's a very traditional concept of centrality and marginality in culture. Who gets to be central, who gets to be active, who gets to be in control of the situation, mm-hmm. versus who's really there to be supportive.
And yeah, who gets to cheer the boys on and also
right.
display their fertility and sexuality.
That's right. And then I also think it's interesting because football is a really rule-bound game. It's in many ways, at heart, rules about, it's a game about rules and conformity, right? There are lots of rules, and they're well-established, and if people just take their places and do what they're supposed to do, everything's going to work the way it's supposed to work. And so that idea of there being a playbook and of there being a structure that everybody needs to stick to has lots of off-the-field ideas and ramifications. I'd also say that it's undeniable that brute force is such an essential part of this game, right? And there's no getting around the glorification of physical dominance and violence. And, you know, we want to be able to celebrate people's athleticism, but do we necessarily have to do it in this way? I would say no.
Yeah, it sort of socializes. It's, you know, thinking about this interview and reading, it seems to me that it socializes, especially the boys, but everybody, into the and it really does it into sort of military and police careers. And in the early part of the century, in fact, into vigilanteism. The football teams would lead the fraternity boys into strike breaking. That was very characteristic, actually, in the early years, especially against the Wobblies. The boys at Harvard especially would go down into Boston and beat up workers. 1 year, the workers beat them up,
right,
severely injuring some Harvard boys. None of that, of course, is talked about in the official histories of Harvard. but it seems to me that football still has that sort of it's good for a community, as you pointed out, but it also organizes the community around those values. And it really does marginalize people who don't fit into those values in the community, including strikers.
Yes, I agree. I think it's interesting because I think that most people watching football are obviously not sitting there thinking about social hierarchy. But it's a very hierarchical game. That's what it shares with the military, right? And I think that you see that in the example you gave in terms of there being other kinds of social hierarchies, right? There are people who belong and people who don't belong. And in expressions of masculinity and virility, those hierarchies become the channel through which people can prove themselves, right? And they derive privilege and status from that. And so what we have in football on a daily basis as children play football or as they're football fans, they really do learn lessons about privilege and status. And I just don't think they're particularly good lessons necessarily.
Yeah, earlier, this is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour talking to Soraya Shemily about football and its lessons. Earlier in the interview, you talked about the football being rule-bound, you know, there's everything is demarcated. There's a million rules about how you can block and all sorts of stuff and holding and not holding and when you can. I mean, being a referee is an impossible job because it's so violent. How do you distinguish?
Right.
But it seems to me, though, in one ways it's enormously rule-bound, in another ways the rules of not only football but a lot of sports are not sort of ethical rules that can't be violated. These are rules of behavior where they really aren't, they don't alter behavior, they just penalize some types of behavior. So in fact, football players are all the time, one of the tactics is that you break the rules when you can,
right,
when the authorities are not watching, basically.
Right.
So there's only a few referees, and there's all these guys running around, huge piles of men, so they're always holding one another, but in ways that so that their backs are turned to the referees who can't see what's going on. So, I mean, that's the linemen get frustrated and angry at one another because they're all cheating. But really, it is a game of intense cheating all the time, holding everywhere. And the fans, of course, go crazy when they see the other team doing it, but they're
right.
Boys, they think they're being discriminated against. It happens in basketball, too.
Mm-hmm.
They're not teaching respect for rules. They're teaching how to break rules and not get penalized, and that it's good to break rules if you're not going to get penalized, which is why, of course, you know, it's sort of like an accountant's dream to have that morality, because that's what they do on, let's say, tax forms. And if you're powerful enough and you can intervene with the tax authorities, you really don't have to pay.
Right.
It seems to me it's extremely immoral within a set of rules that are class-based.
Yes. Well, I think it's status-based rules, right?
Yeah.
I mean, people with higher status are less subject to penalty across the board, whatever status you're considering. So sometimes it's class, sometimes it's race, sometimes it's gender, right?
Right.
Gender tends to be the most diffuse of those. It's the one that's constantly lurking in the background of everything because we live in such close intimacy and have daily interactions with people of other genders, right? And other sexes. But no, that's right. And so athletes not only have status in our culture, they have status among each other, among themselves, And as you say, they're going to take advantage of those rule exceptions and entitlements when they can. I think the question is, what happens when they leave the field, right? The field has its own issues and problems, very highly regulated, clear lines and penalties, and as you say, those rules are being broken. But I think that the incidence of criminal behavior off the field is notable. You know, I think that the fact that student athletes, for example, they make up only something like 3.3% of the U.S. college population, but they're responsible for over 19% of sexual assaults and 37% of intimate partner violence cases on campus. I think those things are connected. They're not disconnected.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for The Old Mole, talking to Soraya Chemly. Soraya, there's another side, of course, and the argument is very similar to sort of violence on TV, that argument. The people, the TV networks and the advertisers and the rest of them say, oh, violence on TV, yes, we have it, but there's a lot of violence on TV. But really what it does is, first, it allows the public to sublimate. It's instinctual to be violent and to be rageful. Football really teaches rage. You have to be enraged to play the game because it's too painful. If not, you have to, it's not only to ignore pain, you don't feel it when you're in a complete, and that's being in the zone, and that's what they do. All players do it. When you get old, you can't do it anymore. So, they have a lifespan of, 3.5 years in the NFL, a little bit less, the average player. But it's violent and rageful. But the apologists for it say, well, rage is instinct in human life. What football does is teach kids how to control it, how to do it within the rules, and then they say after the game, and this is what the NFLPA, the Players Association, actually won from the owners who hate them at first, hated the players doing it. After the game, they went and talked and showed respect and affection for one another. It's actually quite moving. For me, the most moving part of football games is the end. Mm-hmm. When it's over, and then you see these guys who are killing one another, they go up and say hello and talk about the family. And it seems to me that humanizes it. But on the other hand, it humanizes it, but it's within just the most personal structure. It doesn't humanize it in terms of sort of the larger significance of football, of creating these hierarchies. And it's within the hierarchies and within the sort of violent culture and within the domination and military domination, really, that then there are these kinds of community and solidarity. But those are not communities and solidarities that I think, deserve any respect.
Well, I mean, I think that that's right. I think you can have a type of fraternity that doesn't involve the construction of masculinity that is definitively harmful to men, right? So the fact of the matter is, it's a super brutal sport. They're gladiators, right? You don't want your gladiators to be friends with each other because then they won't hurt each other. That's really the problem that you just described, right?
Right.
But football is one manifestation of the way constructions of masculinity and constructions of gender have serious health consequences for men, right? They engage in much riskier behavior in the performance of masculinity, and football is one example of that. So, I think clearly we live in a really violent culture. I mean, we, for example, when you look at gun deaths as an expression of violence, we have 88 guns per 100 people and some outrageous number of gun-related deaths compared to every other developed country on the planet. And there are men in those countries too, right? So this idea that somehow all men are radically violent and that they all need to have to find outlets for this violence, it's a little extreme, right? We have these hyper-violent ideals in our media that kind of teach boys these lessons about masculinity. And we seem to feel that it's out of our control to define those things, and it isn't out of our control. We've just kind of ceded them to these stereotypes and these ideas.
Soraya, we have another couple minutes at the most. And so we'll have to talk about next time, but maybe you can give us a little introduction. What are the alternatives? And you're a parent. How do you, what do you do with your kids to sort of to create a very different culture and values?
You know, I think that's a great question. I think that's probably a question many, many people ask. I know it's very difficult if you have a son to say, no, you can't play football, right? Football is, it's, you know, to say no to football is, for many people, saying no to being an American. It's a very, there are lots of, there's a lot of patriotism wrapped up in football. But I do think it's interesting that football continues to be the sport. And there was a book written by Mariah Burton Nelson in the 90s called The Stronger Women Get, The More Men Love Football. And it's about sexism in the American culture of sports. And I really think that it behooves parents to take a step back and think about the messages that you and I were talking about and the messages that they actually want their kids to have. So there are lots and lots and lots of sports out there that are alternatives to this one. It's an actual decision you make whether or not your children are going to play this sport or whether they're going to support this sport, whether you're going to spend your family time together attending games or watching games. And I just think that athletic kids have so many options today that they should be explored far more thoroughly. And, you know, you and I didn't even talk about the issue of people's bodies and their brains and the likelihood that real harm can come to people playing games
right.
like this.
Soraya Chemaly, if you want to read her work, though, her last name is spelled Chemaly. Soraya, Soraya. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Thanks very much for having me, Bill. Have a good day.
You too.
Okay, bye-bye.
So sitting up most cautiously, I stretch and shake my head. All tense now, for I must decide which side to leave the bed. The point to first consider is the side of the bed most near, awakening in the middle causes me endless nights of fear. I'm nearer to the left side, but it's farther from the door.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host, Denise Morris. We just heard Pete Seeger singing What Next from his album Dangerous Songs, 1966. That was written by folk musician and poet, songwriter as well, Len Chandler. We'll hear more of Pete Seeger's music throughout the show, and we'll hear a little bit from Bill Resnick about Pete Seeger following his death last week. Later in the program, we'll hear Joe Clement interview Jeff McDonald and Peter Oxform. Jeff McDonald's recently written a piece on Counterpunch, Who Needs the Minimum Wage? They'll discuss the issues surrounding that question. And we'll hear Larry Bolden review Divergent, a book written by Veronica Roth for young adults. But next, we're going to hear Fran Michel talking about education in the age of neoliberalism.
Good morning, Moles. This is Fran Michel, here with what may be the first of a series of well-read reads on higher education in the age of neoliberalism. You may know that the Portland teachers are headed for a strike vote on Wednesday. The bus drivers who deliver students to and from their homes and the member unions of the District Council of Trade Unions are also looking at a possible strike. But so too are faculty at Portland State University. According to Jose Padin of the PSU Faculty Union, the yearly payroll of PSU's president and top management has increased by $5 million, while the average faculty salary is $38,000 per year. This is not unique to PSU. As Ron Cox argues in a review essay on the corporatization of higher education, the administrative bureaucracies of U.S. universities have enlarged their ranks, their staff, and their embedded dependency on the marketplace and the corporate sector over the past 40 years. At the same time, full-time faculty positions have steadily declined, while universities are relying much more on adjuncts and instructors to teach undergraduate students. A precipitous reduction in public financing has driven these trends, but the political economy of neoliberalism offers a broader conceptual framework. The university culture increasingly privileges those disciplines that can patent, brand, and market products through corporate partnerships over disciplines that encourage critical thinking designed to engage democratic citizenship and to challenge the status quo. As universities maneuver to replace the steady decline in public funding from the 1990s to the present, we see tuition hikes and greater reliance on wealthy donors and corporate partnership. The costs of tuition and fees at public universities have risen by 300% versus the Consumer Price Index from 1990 to the present, exceeding the costs of healthcare, energy, and housing. Meanwhile, the Department of Education projects that the U.S. government stands to make about $185 billion on student debt over the next decade. The cost burdens of higher education have been transferred from the rich to the middle and working class, eviscerating the very concept of the public university in favor of market-based practices and incentives. We can see this as an outcome of a 40-year political assault from conservative intellectuals, right-wing think tanks and foundations, financed with corporate money and supported by politicians from both political parties who have accepted and promoted the marketization of the university. We can see roots of the attack on public universities within a business-led critique of the costs of financing a public sector that has increasingly constrained the private sector's pursuit of profit. As early as 1971, Lewis Powell began to frame this critique of the public university in the context of a long memo written for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Powell expressed concern about the decline of business influence in politics and frustration that leaders in the system of free enterprise were unable to control universities, even though they ran university board of trustees and funded universities with their tax dollars. In 1987, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development reported on education and recommended that university administration would need to dismantle strong forms of collegial control that made universities less manageable and replace them with strong corporate-style administrators. According to the report, only radical groups, some of which were housed in universities, were delusional enough to embrace the image of a society in which economic considerations take second place to quality of life. Such nostalgic considerations led these radicals to not pay attention to the realities of economic competition. In the 1980s, the new right launched a sustained attack on multiculturalism and political correctness on university campuses. A key tactic of the movement was to rely on a long American tradition of anti-intellectualism to critique humanities and the social sciences as being feeding grounds for un-American attitudes and critiques of American society. The essence of this project was to create a context in which critical thinking, essential to democratic participation in the polity and the economy, has been eviscerated in favor of a market-based approach to knowledge. If knowledge acquisition cannot help a student find a job, what good is it? The growth of the public university system, much like the K-12 system in general, was always located in the particular parameters of capitalist power relationships and designed to serve elite interests in the broader economy and polity. The public university system, at the height of its grandeur in the 1960s, was a system made possible by an infusion of Cold War military spending. But the Cold War structure of the public university at times enabled a wider dissemination of public knowledge into the broader society. The older liberal model of governance largely left public universities alone to run their own affairs, but no longer. As Cox summarizes, the expanded administrative hierarchy entails a multi-tiered set of power relationships that have relegated two-thirds of the nation's faculty to adjunct status. The number of full-time, tenure-track college and university professors have fallen from 67% of the faculty in the 1970s to 30% of the professoriate today. So we see middle-aged PhDs working as adjunct faculty and surviving only with the help of food stamps and other public assistance. We see the growth in student debt that can never be erased, even by declaring bankruptcy. We see cuts that eliminate entire programs, not just in women's studies or ethnic studies, not even just in philosophy or French, but in computer science and physics. We see the proletarianization of faculty, the rise in for-profit colleges, and the introduction of impoverished versions of pseudo-education promised by massive open online courses, or MOOCs. As Cox puts it, universities, like other institutions of neoliberal capitalism, have adopted more rigid corporate structures that have enhanced the authority and power of administrators, reduced the voices of faculty, and imposed greater costs on middle and working class students, whose debts have helped finance those that have benefited most from the system. The hollowing out of professional autonomy has been aided by a multi-tiered structure of full-time faculty, instructors, and adjuncts. Part-timers are asked to work much more for much less in teaching the growing student population whose rising tuition has become key to maintaining the system. This is no way to carry out genuine education. Workers and middle-class citizens used to be able to receive an education at affordable rates. But when that education clashed with corporate profit-making and wealth generation for a privileged elite, the cost burdens have been drawn out of the public sphere and forced downward on the masses. What is needed is a vigorous public movement that defends the concept of the public university as a vital right of an informed citizenry and a necessary tool to help reverse the widening gap between rich and poor. For the Old Mall Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michel.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes, all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same. And the people in the houses all go to the university and they all get put in boxes, little boxes, all the same.
That's Pete Seeger singing Little Boxes. The Little Boxes was written by Malvina Reynolds. She was an American songwriter and activist. She lived between 1900 and 1978. She had a good start with parents who were Jewish immigrants and socialists who opposed the war, World War I. Pete Seeger will hear more of his music, and also a tribute by Bill Resnick at the end of our program. Was a great collaborator, and this morning we're hearing music that was mostly written by other folks who were activists and songwriters, along with such a wonderful group of folks between, you know, the 40s, 50s, 60s, and on. Next up, we have Joe Clement, who talks with Jeff McDonald and Peter Oxform. Jeff McDonald written a piece on Counterpunch, Who Needs the Minimum Wage? And here it is to Joe.
I'm Joe Clement, and I'm joined here by Jeff McDonald and Peter Oxform. They are contributors to a web blog of sorts called Ruthless Criticism, and more recently, Joff has published an article through Counterpunch called Who Needs the Minimum Wage, which takes a critical look at the minimum wage and boosterism for it from the perspective of the abolition of the wage system. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, great to be here.
So I want to talk a little bit about where you're coming from in writing this, Joff, as a contributor of Ruthless Criticism.
I should explain that Ruthless Criticism is a website that mostly consists of translations that me and my friends have done of articles and lectures that come from a German political publication called Gegenstandpunkt, which roughly means something like counterpoint in English. And Peter is actually the editor of the English website of Gegenstandpunkt. So that's how I know Peter. And our purpose is to promote discussions and lectures where people should think about the actual causes of things that everybody dislikes, like poverty and war and racism, and get to the real core of what these things are.
Let's turn back to the article itself, which was published about a month ago in Counterpunch. You start with a nod to the way that, you know, our public discourse kind of locked in a certain way of talking about the wage system.
Yeah, maybe I can say something about this. The framework of the debate is pretty much on the quantity of the minimum wage and not on its quality, what it really is. What is a wage? What is a minimum wage? What is it for? Nobody denies that you can't live on $7 or $8 an hour work. So the discussion gets away from whether you can live on it or not and moves towards what every public discussion moves toward, which is the overall public good, the nation, and whether it needs a higher minimum wage or not.
I like how you put it at one point, that economists are, you know, more inclined to try and predict the outcome of this or that minimum wage policy rather than questioning the relation of what a wage is. And What does that way of interrogating the wage, of calling its existence into question, what does that look like in terms of how do we advocate for what people are looking for in the minimum wage, which is, you know, the access to the means of their physical and emotional and all other kinds of reproduction, and what could be beyond the wage relation?
I would start with asking, what is the reason that people go to work in this society? They need a source of income because they need money to live. Without money, you can't have access to anything. Everything has a price, and everybody knows. So in order to get money, you have to find an employer who will pay you a wage in order that you can live. And on your own initiative, you can't just work because you don't have the means of work. The means of work belong to other people. This used to be known as the capitalist class, to use old-fashioned language. They're the people who actually own the factories and the means of life. So if you want to work, you have to find one of these people who has an interest in employing you. And their interest in employing you isn't to give you money. They want something from it. And they, what they want is your work. So what you do is you sell your ability to work for them. You sell their control, essentially, over your work, and then they thereby own the results of your work. So this is a very hostile and antagonistic relationship. What the employer is interested in getting from the worker is a difference between what he pays for the work and what he can make in terms of prices in the difference so that he gets a profit.
What about the professional classes, and not just doctors and lawyers, but the self-employed independent contractors? I mean, whether they are doing semi-professional work or whether they are just classified because of their tax status.
Well, of course, there is this, you might call it an intermediate class of people who manage to make more money with their work, and part of this is, of course, intellectual workers who are not directly controlled by a boss, because the result requires a great deal of freedom of thought and action. So this always exists and always has, but it's, what can you say about it? It is still work for money. It's no longer wage work then at some point. If you're talking about independent businessmen selling services to larger businessmen, then this is not a wage relation anymore. This becomes just a relation among businessmen supplying services to each other.
Yeah, there is, I think, a popular version of dissatisfaction with the wage system, as it's put, becoming your own boss.
Yeah. This is a kind of part of the American dream, I suppose, to be able to escape wage labor by being your own boss, as you say. Of course, it happens. It also goes the other way, that small businessmen fall out and become re-proletarianized. It's no amelioration of the wage relation to say that a few people can escape it now and then.
Professional is kind of the hot word today that people want to be, that I think that cloaks some of the negative perception or aura of the business person by kind of making it seem like a vocation, like a thing that really comes from what people want to do. And that these realities kind of intermix, where it's not just that we are fooled by the lie of there being a way out through individual solutions, but that there are individual solutions being tailored to the perpetuation of the wage relation and capitalism in general.
Yeah, maybe you could say it this way. It's not a critique of the wage system to escape from it, or to be involved in some kind of hidden way, as you suggest. The guys who, in the factory, who dream of setting up their own business or going to night school or something like this and improving themselves, would have no problem with setting up a business where they become the employer and instead of being the employed. So the whole idea of everybody making money off of each other is never criticized by any movement to professionalize certain aspects of work. It is still the same game. And, of course, if you're a professional, you still have to sell whatever it is to somebody. You're still in the selling business. If you're not directly under the control of a capitalist, fine, then you're not really part of the working class anymore. But I thought we really wanted to talk about this the wage relation per se.
Yeah, I'm...
Not some of its... you know, there are lots of variations in capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Old forms of existence still have not been totally destroyed. There's remaining vestiges of all kinds of things still going on. Piecework still exists here and there, and et cetera. So,
yeah, I recently was doing piecework review writing, and it taught me a lot about what working for a wage meant.
The wage is a particular form of payment for wage labor.
Mm-hmm.
Labor. I mean, it's in, you know, where it's the day is divided into hours, and you end up with a rate per hour, something like this, to make it look as if the payment is for time. That's the particular wage form. That's the predominant wage form of being paid for labor. But there are other forms as well, and I don't think they really. These intermediary forms, these fuzzy areas where you don't quite know if you're an employer or an employer, these are, of course, exist, but they don't really change the basic relation that's going on. I think that's what we need to focus on.
I want to, I guess, bring it back to the article by asking, what is the cynicism of public policy that you refer to in the article?
Well, there's never the question of how to end poverty. It's always a question of how does these poor people affect a state budget? And aren't they a problem for the nation? Maybe they become a criminal problem or problem of public order or something like that. You'll very seldom see any kind of commentary in public about how poverty is bad for poor people. That's just not something that's a concern.
You say that there isn't really any space in the public discourse for the effects of poverty on poor people?
There are some, but the question is, always, of course, can the working class maintain itself somehow? But maintain itself as a working class that can function in the economy. And this is the cynical part, because it sets the limits on what would be considered a reasonable wage. On the one hand, pure survival. On the other hand, functioning in a capitalist society where your labor has to be profitable for somebody else. Another way of looking at it, when some politician starts calling for, we need more good jobs, these are not jobs that they themselves would ever dream of taking. This is a cynical point of view, that 45 years on an assembly line counts as a good life and something to be promoted.
I'm Joe Clement, and I am talking with Jeff McDonald and Peter Oxford about the wage system and the minimum wage as a crucial function of the wage system, and in particular, an article that Joff wrote for Counterpunch called Who Needs the Wage System? So what's the difference between, as you put it, asking how do we make poverty functional and the question of how do we eliminate poverty? What does it start to look like in terms of policy or in terms of general things when we start to ask those kind of questions?
That's a strange point of view, because making work functional for a capitalist society is the whole of policy discussion in this area. Having a different relation between work and wealth is not a subject for policy whatsoever. It's outside the realm of public opinion that's suitable for a policy discussion.
And certain bourgeois circles, I'm sure, but, you know, have, I think, increased chatter in at least the online mediums, but also on network news and radio about a basic income and about a resurgent view of the welfare state that goes beyond the mere patchwork kind of system that we knew of in the 20th century. In Switzerland, even, they are in the process of bringing a basic income to a referendum, and it's going to be investigated before it's brought to the vote. I don't know whether it's, what do these phenomena mean in terms of how do we open the question of what is the meaning of the wage relation itself?
What does this mean? You're still talking about income. That means you're still talking about a society with money, wages, prices, and profits. Only a question of managing the whole thing and making it smoother somehow. And every country treats this slightly differently because of their different circumstances. America is particularly radical about having a large segment of the population that just sees individual wage work as not needing any supplementation. And if people fall by the wayside, this is their own business and no business of the state to intervene. Whereas in a small country like Switzerland, which by the way has quite a bit of foreign wage workers, there's a much more, what can you say, urgent matter of whether the working class will reproduce itself. These kinds of differences in policies to address the poverty of work, they're not really invitations to intervene in the discussion. Our point of view is that the discussion itself has to be criticized.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. I've been talking with Jeff McDonald and Peter Oxforn about the wage system and the limits of the minimum wage as a perspective on economic justice. We'll link to Jeff's article in Counterpunch, Who Needs the Minimum Wage, and the website that we talked about earlier, Ruthless Criticism. For the Old Mole, I'm Joe Clement.
These are union songs, and we're singing them loud because we got a union of which we're mighty proud. The first one, you've heard the tune before, but the Wobblies, those guys that knew the score, they changed the words. Well, why don't you help us out on It's the Commonwealth of Toil?
In the gloom of mighty cities, mid the roar of whirling wheels, we are toiling on like chattel slaves of old. And our masters hope to keep us ever thus beneath their heels, and to coin our very lifeblood into gold. But we have a glowing dream of how fair the world will seem, when each man can live a life secure and free. When the earth is owned by labor, and there's joy and peace for all, in the commonwealth of toil that is to be.
They would keep us cowed and beaten, cringing meekly at their feet. They would stand between each worker and his bread. Shall we yield our lives up to them for the bitter crust we eat? Shall we only hope for heaven when we're dead?
But we have a glowing dream of how fair the world will seem, when each man can live his life secure and free. When the earth is owned by labor, and there's joy and peace for all, in the commonwealth of toil that is to be.
That is The Commonwealth of Toil, sung by Pete Seeger, written by Ralph Chaplin. You may have heard his other good song, Solidarity Forever, another great collaboration. Next up on The Old Mole, we have Larry Bolden reviewing the novel Divergent by Veronica Roth. Larry?
Good morning. In this age of electronic games and devices, I'm always glad to see or hear that young people are reading. I have a niece, Kate, who, like I, is an avid reader. Knowing that I love books, she gave me for Christmas a favorite book of hers, and I read it in a couple of days over the holiday. Since I've almost never reviewed what might be called teen fiction, I decided to talk about this book today. I'm so proud of her as a studious reader and expect her to be a good member of the world she finds herself in. The book is titled Divergent and was the first novel for Veronica Roth. From what I hear, it will soon be made into a movie. In fact, I think it's coming out in March. And it is the first of a trilogy that will have a very large following among young people. Besides being quite an interesting adventure mystery, I think the moral questions and dilemmas presented in the book make it much more important than simply an interesting page-turner. The plot is a fairly complicated one, and there are many surprises in the end, none of which I have any intention of divulging, but I will lay out the general theme of the book and say why I think it is a good read for serious-minded young people, and quite entertaining for us older folk as well. The novel is a futuristic dystopian description of a rigorously stratified society divided into five factions: abnegation, candor, erudite, amity, and dauntless. reminiscent of Marge Piercy's 1976 novel, Woman on the Edge of Time. At the age of 16, all children go through a choosing ceremony, at which time they may either remain in the group they have been raised in or leave their families and choose a new faction. In Piercy's overtly political and feminist novel, adolescents choose a new name for themselves and leave their families in a kind of coming-of-age ceremony. After that time, they may choose to continue to relate with their families, but no longer as parents or sons and daughters, but simply as equal members of society. The 16-year-olds in Divergent take an aptitude test shortly before the choosing ceremony and are told then which group they have an aptitude for. However, they are not bound by the results of the aptitude test and may freely choose a group other than the one they are born to or the one the aptitude test suggests. The names of the groups describe roughly their roles. The lead character, Beatrice, who changes her name to Triss, comes from an abnegation family. Abnegation folks are selfless and do service work for the community. They wear gray clothing, do not call attention to themselves in either dress or action. Candor are straightforward and apt to say whatever's on their mind, quite willing to debate with anyone who holds opposing views, and quite willing to give critical appraisals. Quote, their faction values honesty and sees the truth as black and white, so that is what they wear. Close quote. The erudite class are the intellectuals who study hard and are supposed to serve the community in planning decisions. The dauntless are the warriors who protect the fences that border the cities and are known for their bravery. They are tattooed and have body piercings. They jump onto and off of moving trains and perform other acts of rather reckless bravery. The amity are less clear to define but are often described as laughing and singing and wearing colorful colors, reds and yellows. There are also some who are factionless, either because they've been kicked out of their chosen faction or have failed to choose. The factionless are left to fend for themselves, and it is clearly dangerous and daunting to be without a faction. As Beatrice tells us early in the book, the choosing ceremony is an important and sometimes frightful time for the young. Quote, I will decide on a faction. I will decide the rest of my life. I will decide to stay with my family or abandon them. Close quote. Although it is possible to have a bit of time with family on Visitor's Day, even if one chooses a different faction, there is tremendous peer pressure to treat faction over family, and the chances of any meaningful connections with family if one chooses a different faction are minimal. Much to the surprise of their abnegation parents, both Beatrice and her brother Caleb choose to leave their family and faction. Triss chooses the dauntless faction, and Caleb the erudite. Although Caleb re-enters the action late in the book, it is Triss's initiation into the Dauntless faction and the daily life that it involves that is most closely described. The reader also realizes early in the book that Triss's aptitude test has indicated quite divergent results, although a kind tester saves her from actually being labeled divergent, since divergents are seen as threats to the existing order and, if discovered, punished by becoming factionless. What I find uplifting about the book are the moral dilemmas Triss is faced with because of her divergent aptitudes and her love for her family. Eventually, she comes to believe that, quote, selflessness and bravery aren't that different, close quote. And instead of shunning her divergent tendencies, she embraces them. Along with a brave boyfriend who is a trainer for the Dauntless Initiates and also shows divergent aptitudes, they uncover a sinister plot hatched by a power-hunger erudite who has found a way to electronically brainwash the Dauntless and use their fearlessness to her own ends. I also found the portrayal of the relationship between Tobias and Triss to be a good and wholesome one. While there are mild sexual overtones to the book, rather than appealing to a teenage audience by sensationalizing the sexual element, Roth accentuates fidelity and genuine caring for the other rather than focusing on sex. I was often reminded of Plato's distinction between genuine courage and foolhardiness as I read this book. There is a plea for tolerance to be found in its pages and a clear warning against allowing peer pressure to get in the way of morality and truth. All in all, were I a parent of a teenager, I would recommend this book to them, as I recommend it to you. Indeed, I have to admit I will probably see the movie when it comes out, although I rather doubt I will read the other books in the Promised Trilogy. I've been talking about Veronica Roth's novel, Divergent. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Grain of sand. One grain of sand in all the world. One grain of sand, one little boy, one little girl. One grain of sand, one lonely star up in the blue. One grain of sand, one little me, one little you. One grain of sand, one grain of sand on an endless shore. One grain of sand, one little life. Who'd ask for more? One grain of sand.
One grain. You're listening of sand. To the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, Oregon. That's 90.7. That was Pete Seeger, One Grain of Sand, from his recording Dangerous Songs, 1966. One Grain of Sand was written as a lullaby in 1956 and then made into a bedtime book and published in January 2000. Well, now it's time to hear a little bit more about Pete Seeger, who died last week, Monday, the 27th of January. Bill Resnick is here to talk a little bit about Pete Seeger. Bill?
Yeah, very briefly, and to recommend things to read that are really interesting. Of course, Pete Seeger died last week. His songs will live on. Music, even more than writing, lives on. I've read lots of commentaries and tributes to him. Of course, everybody loved Pete Seeger. I didn't see any right-wingers who bothered to write. But several writers, progressives, expressed reservations about him, particularly his work and influence in the late 30s when he was part of the Almanac Singers, who told the line of the Soviet Empire. So they recite that when Stalin signed the peace pact with Hitler, it gave a green light for Hitler to invade Poland and start mass killing and genocide. For those years, the Almanac Singers did peace songs opposing U.S. military preparation for action against Germany, basically supporting the Soviet Union's position. Then, of course, Hitler broke his pact with Stalin, invaded Russia, and Seeger and the Almanacs became solidly pro-war and anti-Nazi. Seeger later broke with the Communist Party USA, but generally avoided discussing his work in that period, which in fact basically supported the party in the U.S. when during that period they drove many democratic socialists, I mean radically democratic socialists, not Democrats, they drove them from the unions, and actually there were pitched battles and the CP attempted to destroy the Democratic left. Those were horrible struggles. But even those who recant, Pete Seeger is not on the right side in that period. But even those who recall those dark years, they paid tribute to Seeger through his last 50-some years. He devoted almost all of his life to many struggles, had enormous influence on music, stood for engaged music, introduced so many singers, old-timers and new. He was one of the people, for example, who rescued Woody Guthrie and many others. Pete Seeger led a very heroic, dedicated, committed life. His music is wonderful. Few of us have not done things out of loyalties that turned out not to be the ones that we would, when we think back, that we would have chosen. If you want to read a wonderful reminisce and appreciation for Pete Seeger, read Dave Marsh in his newsletter, Rock and Rap Confidential, which was republished on the website Counterpunch.
That's Pete Seeger, Dave Marsh on Counterpunch. It's a wonderful discussion of Pete Seeger. That's Bill Resnick for the Old Mole.
Thank you, Bill.
Of the place that I lived on the wild, windy plain in the month of
Friday Hour. It is a collective labor that brings you the Old Mole every Monday morning at 9 a.m. I want to thank our guests and contributors this morning, Bill Resnick and Soraya Shemily, Fran Michelle, Larry Bolden, Joe Clement and his guest, Jeffrey McDonald and Peter Oxfarm. We have also been listening to the music of Pete Seeger, who died last week, Monday, January 27th. We are back again, of course, next week with more news, views, and interviews. And next up on KBOO, it will be Air Cascadia with Chris Andre. We'll close out this morning with Pete Seeger singing Woody Guthrie's song, So Long, Been Good to Know Ya.
It's been good to know you so long. It's been good to know you so long. It's been good to know you. This dusty old dust is a-getting my home. And I got to be drifting along. Well, the sweethearts, they sat in the dark and they sparked. They hugged and they kissed in that dusty old ark. Sighed, they cried, they hugged and they kissed. But instead of marriage, they were talking like this. Honey, so long, been good to know you, so long. It's been good to know you, so long. It's been good to know you. This dusty old dust is a-getting my home. And I got to be drifting along.
And it is 10 a.m. You are tuned to KBOO in Portland. Coming right up is Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, host Barbara Bernstein speaks with Dr. Deborah Davis, president and co-founder of Environmental Health Trust, about how the West Virginia emergency illustrates our inability to monitor and regulate pollution so that communities can be protected from toxic releases. At 11 on Health Watch, host Dr. David Naiman speaks with Jonathan Baylor, host of a popular syndicated health radio show, an expert in nutrition and exercise, and the author of The Calorie Myth, How to Eat More, Exercise Less, Lose Weight, and Live Better. And at 11:30, Madness Radio guest Tomi Gomori looks at how the medical model of psychiatry operates under significant scientific fallacies. And thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support for community radio. If you aren't a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog.
50 years ago, four lads from Liverpool invaded America.
You say you will love me if I have to go. You'll be thinking of me. Somehow I will know.
Join KBOO February 7th from noon to 4 as we pay tribute to John, Paul, George, and Ringo.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Monday, February 3rd, 2014, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, KBOO.fm on the web. First, some headlines. We are still trying to get Ivan Malesky with Family Farms on the air to talk a little bit more about the disastrous farm bill. Farmers, on that note, across the Dakotas in the center of the country are up in arms over the Environmental Protection Agency signing off on the Keystone XL. I'll be trying to get those documents. I want to know what research was used to decide that the Keystone XL pipeline would have no significant environmental impact. There is a protest tonight, and I'm sure that KBOO will have all that information for you. The phone number is 503-705-1943 for more information. Back to the headlines. This weekend, Punxsutawney Phil wasn't the only one who saw his shadow. Members of Service Employee International Union Local 503 rejected their leadership's effort to rewrite the local's bylaws and merge with another SEIU local. And thanks, Maisie. Oregon's own prognosticating insectivore, Maisie the hedgehog, woke up on Saturday morning and more or less turned off the alarm and went back to sleep, pulling her shadow over herself. 6 more weeks of winter, Oregon, and that's not counting the week that it rains during the Rose Festival. Wednesday deadline looms, a new teacher's contract is still in play, and recent Monday nights have been anything but light. Parents and students stand for the most part in solidarity with the city school district union, Portland Association of Teachers. Gwen Sullivan heads up that organization. She has told me that she would like to join us on Air Cascadia. She is in negotiations all day, every day at this point. And it's, of course, as always, it's the parents and the students that know the true value of teachers, trying to sell them short, while at the same time we have massive amounts of money spent on college sports, athletics. We witness the locker rooms at the certain professional sports teams whose names we shan't mention. But nonetheless, there is money.